You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
For years, parents, social scientists, and others have raised concerns that American boys are in crisis. Nearly 20% of high school-age boys have received a diagnosis of ADHD. Many worry about the effects of electronic media, especially video games, and fewer young men are making what sociologists have traditionally called the transition to adulthood by age 30. In an updated edition of his book, Boys Adrift, The Five Factors Driving the Epidemic of Unmotivated Boys and Underachieving Young Men, Dr. Leonard Sachs continues his study of the social and psychological factors that affect both boys and girls, often very differently. It's published by Basic Books, and I'm very pleased that it brings Leonard Sachs back to our show. And we welcome your input. If you want to give us a call, if you're a parent, an educator, or anyone with thoughts on the subject, our number here is 212-433-9692. You can write to us on our show page at wnyc.org/Lopate or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. Dr. Sachs, welcome back.
Thanks for inviting me.
Men have a disproportionately large share of leadership positions in business, politics, and academia. From the standpoint of performance or motivation, where's the problem?
Well, there's definitely a generational divide. When you look at who are the highest achievers, who's earning the highest honors, for example, Boston Public Schools publishes the names and faces of their valedictorians at the 42 public high schools in the city of Boston. And this year, June 2016, of the 42 valedictorians, 30 were girls and 12 were boys. And as I show in the book, that's pretty consistent across the United States. Among those earning highest honors, girls now outnumber the boys by more than 2-to-1. Now, that you talked about the current generation of leaders. That would then be the previous generation. And indeed, going back 25, 30 years, you find pretty much the opposite. I remember when I graduated from my public high school, Shaker Heights High, the valedictorian was a boy. Seemed like the valedictorian was always a boy. The editor of the school newspaper was a boy. The editor was Andy Borowitz, who now writes a humor column for The New Yorker. In that era, the boys greatly outnumbered the girls. Today, the girls greatly outnumber the boys. And some will say, okay, why is that a problem? The pendulum has swung the other way. But the nature of the shift is disadvantageous to both girls and boys.
Several presidential commissions on education have studied related issues over the years, going all the way back to the Truman Report in 1947. Then there was the Reagan administration publishing A Nation at Risk in 1983. So were the issues different in the past?
Yes, I think the issues were quite different in the past. And indeed, in Boys Adrift, I talk about A Nation at Risk and how that report was published with great fanfare and called attention to the fact that, oh my goodness, the United States is losing its number one position. Japan is getting ahead of us, and we need to hold public school teachers more accountable. That report, I argued, was one of the factors that inaugurated the high-stakes testing era, which I think has been, again, very harmful both to girls and to boys.
Now, are there agreed standards for motivation or achievement? Is it just a matter of the grades that lead to people graduating with honors?
Well, indeed. You can choose different parameters depending on what argument you want to make. And in my book, Boys Adrift, I describe how various columnists have said the boys' crisis is a myth. And it's easy to make that argument, for example, if you only look at high school graduation rates. If you just look at who's graduating from high school, it's easy to make the claim that, well, there may be a boy crisis for low-income boys of color, because low-income boys of color are much less likely to graduate from high school than their sisters are. But if you look at white boys in Chappaqua, you don't see any gender gap in high school graduation rates. But I argue that high school graduation is a pretty low bar for white boys in Chappaqua, because they're all going to graduate from high school. You have to dig a little deeper. You look at who's taking multiple AP exams, who's graduating with honors, And when you look more carefully below the surface of high school graduation rates, then you do find a profound gender gap that is just as pronounced among white kids in Chappaqua as it is among low-income boys of color in, say, the South Bronx.
Well, let's take a call from Harry from Forest Hills, New York, see
Hi,
what he's thinking. Hi, Harry.
Hi. Yeah, I have a question regarding this issue. There was something on PBS a number of years ago hosted by David Suzuki, a science reporter, where they did bring up the fact that there are fewer men entering the teacher workforce. If this may have an impact on that,
you mean male teachers as role models?
Well, just male teachers in the classroom, that there are fewer than there were decades ago.
Yes, the caller is absolutely right, that there's been a decline, especially in the elementary grades. And when I meet with kids today, they're surprised to find that there was an era in American education as recently as 30 years ago when it was common to find men teaching second graders. Today, well over 90% of elementary school teachers are women. I have visited now more than 400 schools in the last 15 years, and I have been at a number of elementary schools where the only male on the campus was the custodian. But I
have to tell you, I went to school a long, long time ago, and every elementary school teacher I had was a woman.
So, indeed, I do not think...
It wasn't until junior high that I had a male teacher.
There has been a shift. The numbers are there, but I don't think that shift is the key. I don't think that shift that has been documented from a mostly female workforce to an entirely female workforce in kindergarten, first, second grade is really the proximate cause. I think there are other factors in play where the evidence is much stronger. And one of them is that school has become less friendly to boys. What do I mean by that? Well, in your school, is a boy allowed to make a snowball and throw it at another boy who was then throwing snowballs back at him? It was. When I was growing up in my public school district, I grew up on the shores of Lake Erie. We get a lot of snow there, lake effect snow. And throughout the winter months, at recess and lunch, we'd all put on our jackets and go outside and throw snowballs at each other. And the teachers would come out and join us. Students against teachers. I remember Mr. Albers was a great shot. He'd get you right between the eyes every time. That doesn't happen anymore. If two boys are throwing snowballs at each other on school grounds, today a teacher administrator is going to run out and say, "What are you guys doing? You're not allowed to do that here. You want to throw snowballs? Go somewhere else." And the unintended message the boys are getting is that if you want to do things that boys have always done, school's not the place for that. Go somewhere else. And this is not confined to the throwing of snowballs. If you want to draw a picture of a warrior decapitating a dragon at many schools, you will be told that's not allowed. We don't draw violent pictures. We have a zero tolerance policy toward violence. I describe a story in the book where a boy was looking at another boy, pulled back an imaginary bow and arrow, and went boing and was suspended. And the attorney retained by the family said, "That's criminalizing the imagination. There was nothing in the boy's hands. He was imagining a bow and arrow. But because he imagined shooting another boy with a bow and arrow, and then the other boy pretended to shoot him back, both boys were disciplined."
Well, okay, so you write about devaluing masculinity. But shouldn't we be kind of preventing kids from being violent or
indeed
engaging in violent activities?
What does the data show? What works? And we now have good data from longitudinal studies where researchers have compared, okay, these districts are comparable in terms of race, ethnicity, household income. This one district adopts a zero tolerance policy, no drawing of violent pictures, no pretending to shoot a bow and arrow. And the other district does not. Do we see any difference in actual outcomes? Well, we do. The district that adopts the zero tolerance policy has a much higher rate of discipline referrals. Boys are being suspended and even expelled. but there is no decrease in actual violence. We now know that zero tolerance policies that criminalize thinking about Roman gladiators accomplish nothing in terms of decreasing actual violence. And I actually have a section of the book about Dylan Klebold, Eric Harris, Columbine, Virginia Tech. Actual violence is what we're trying to diminish. And the assumption that by prohibiting boys from pointing fingers at each other and saying, bang, bang, you're dead, the assumption that prohibiting that sort of play would decrease actual violence turns out to be an inaccurate assumption. But what it does do is it has the unintended consequence of disengaging many boys and of making academic achievement and school in general uncool for boys.
We have a number of calls from teachers. I'd like to get to them and then address some of the other issues in your book. Andy from Boomtown, New Jersey. Hi, you're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call, Leonard. I called because I have been a teacher at a relatively affluent district in Morris County, and I'm going to my 14th year as a high school English teacher. And we group by ability. So we have a low-level skills class, a mid-level college prep class, and a high-level honors class, and I've taught all levels. What I have found all 14 years is skills level is mostly men. I'd say probably there's 20 kids. It's 18 boys to 2 girls. As you get into the college class, you maybe have 15 boys to 5 girls, and then you hit the honors class, and it's 15 girls to 5 boys. And I've seen this for the 14 years, and what I've mainly noticed is that the male students are much more likely to walk into my class and say, I just don't have the ability to do, you know, X. And I think the more that I engage them kinesthetically, as your caller's been talking about, you know, give them maybe some physical violence, give them the opportunity to get up, move, work in, maybe work in groups based on personality, and they can learn from higher achievers with similar personalities how they function. I've had a lot of success in the last 5 years doing that. And as a one other side note, I have a 6-year-old daughter, and she had a male kindergarten teacher this year, which was surprising and was a very, very positive experience. And he is one of 4 kindergarten teachers in our school. And I guess one other thing, if I can just keep throwing things on, is that we're a regional high school district, so we have a sister district. In my school, the English department is about 20, and I'd say we are evenly split, male and female teachers, whereas in my sister's school, they also have about 20, and they are about, 17 to 3 female teachers to male teachers. So I think it really is hiring choices as well.
And we have another caller who addresses that to some degree. Ellen from Brooklyn. Hi, you're on the air.
Yes. Hi. Thanks for taking my call, Leonard. I have been teaching graduate education in a school of education for 26 years now, in a master's degree program. With all my students are public school teachers, and I have in every single class for all these years. Typically, I have about between 2 and 4 male students, and the rest are female. However, I have found that my male students are extremely caring and connected to their students, to their own students' emotional needs. What I teach is called Foundations of Education and Philosophy of Education. So we talk a lot about fantastic philosophers such as John Dewey and Maxine Green, who actually was my professor over at Teachers College. But they talk about caring and tolerance and nurturance and love and compassion. And she specifically spoke about being wide awake in the classroom and being what's called a reflective practitioner, which I found in all my years of teaching is not a gender-specific characteristic. So it is just about teaching students who are teachers themselves how to embrace traits such as compassion, empathy, caring, and even love, which people are afraid to say that word, as an educator in a classroom, and it works beautifully.
Helen, thank you for calling us. We have to go to a little break, and when we come back, Dr. Sachs, I'm sure there are a lot of things you want to say in response to those calls.
Indeed.
My guest is Dr. Leonard Sachs, whose book, Boys Adrift, The Five Factors Driving the Growing Epidemic of Unmotivated Boys and Underachieving Young Men, is now updated and published by Basic Books. And we will talk about those five factors as well. But first this. We're back with Dr. Lauren Sachs, whose latest book is Boys Adrift, The Five Factors Driving the Growing Epidemic of Unmotivated Boys and Underachieving Young Men, published by Basic Books. You aren't there five milestones that are often taken to signal transition to adulthood? Completing school, leaving home, financial independence, marriage, having a child. Are all of those things changing?
To some degree, but I do want to follow up on Ellen's comment about what we can do about this. I have found that the strategies that really work are to understand the differences between girls and boys. So you'll find a teacher says, write a story about whatever you want. And that's where you find very big differences between girls and boys. And Jared wants to write a story about Roman gladiators decapitating each other. And Melissa wants to write a story about how she felt when she wasn't invited to the party. And I find that at many American schools now, Melissa's story gets a good mark, and the boy's story doesn't. And indeed, that boy may even be referred. He may be, his parents may be advised that he needs counseling. And that's a really big change. You know, I describe how I wrote stories about violent combat and traumatic amputation, and I got awards for writing those stories.
You could have gone on to write Game of Thrones.
Indeed. But the man who writes Game of Thrones is not more likely actually to be an agent of actual violence in the real world. Writing a story about Roman gladiators or medieval combat does not mean that you yourself are more likely to engage in actual violence, and we know this, and yet teachers don't. But when you tell them, when you show them the evidence, then you can see a transformation in the classroom, and you can see that the boys love to write and can become proficient writers if you just encourage them to write the story they want to tell.
Video games seem to hold greater appeal for boys. Many parents are concerned about the amount of time that boys spend playing them. This is kind of what you're talking about. But I was interested to note that one of the most popular and criticized games, Grand Theft Auto, which was introduced almost 20 years ago, in the 20 years since, crime rates have dropped and the economy has grown.
Yes. So certainly I think the argument that video games cause people to be actually violent in the real world is unpersuasive. But we do now have very good evidence, again, from longitudinal cohort studies controlling for race, ethnicity, household income, and even amount of time spent playing video games, that the boy who is playing a violent video game like Grand Theft Auto, Halo, Call of Duty, it undermines his social skills. He becomes less able to use facial expression as a clue to meaning. He becomes less patient. So these video games have consequences. No, they don't cause violent acts, but they do have consequences, that these boys are shifting their motivation from the real world into the virtual world. And I'm seeing so many boys in my own practice and in parents I talk to around this country who say the only thing their son wants to do is go to his bedroom and play his video game, that he is less engaged in engaging real world face-to-face encounters.
Is this happening only in the United States, or are we seeing similar situations in other developed countries?
We're seeing some of these trends, particularly with regard to video games, in other countries. In Japan, there's a whole phenomenon called hikikomori, boys who deliberately live in their bedrooms, and their mothers serve them meals on trays, which are left outside the closed bedroom door. So, yes, we do see this phenomenon of boys adrift, boys disengaged in other developed countries as well.
You've also written a book called Girls on the Edge, The Four Factors Driving the New Crisis for Girls. Are boys at greater risk, or are the risks just different?
The risks are different. So I describe a family in my own practice where the parents are concerned about their son. He's not doing well in school. He's not working hard. He's failing in Spanish. He spends his free time playing video games and looking at pornography. He's 16 years old. The parents are very proud of their daughter, 14. She's getting straight A's, has lots of friends, doing lots of activities. But it turns out she's having trouble getting to sleep. She has having trouble staying asleep. And now we just discovered she's secretly cutting herself with razor blades on her upper inner thigh, where she didn't think her parents would see. She is troubled. Her brother, on the other hand, he's sleeping real well. He sleeps till noon. You have to kick him out of the bed, and he's perfectly happy. His parents are concerned about him, but he's not. The daughter's very anxious. They same parents, same family, but the son and the daughter have very different problems.
My guest is Leonard Sachs. His book, Boys Adrift, The Five Factors Driving the Growing Epidemic of Unmotivated Boys and Underachieving Young Men, is published by Basic Books. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You were a guest on the show 10 years ago in June 2006, and then the first edition of Boys Adrift was published in 2007. What have we learned in the 10 or so years since?
Well, one of the really dramatic developments is the research on medications for attention deficit disorder, Adderall, Vyvanse, Ritalin, Concerta, Metadate. There's now very compelling and disturbing evidence that these medications damage the motivational center of the brain. I present that evidence in the updated edition of Boys Adrift. And that's, you asked about us, our country compared to others. That's where we truly are an outlier. A boy in the United States is 14 times more likely to be on medication for ADD compared to a boy in the United Kingdom. A kid in the United States is 40 times more likely to be medicated for bipolar disorder compared to a kid in Germany, 93 times more likely to be on medications like Risperdal, Zyprexa, compared to a kid in Italy. The United States has become an outlier in the use of prescription medications for kids. In this country, and only in this country, medication is now the first resort for any kid who's having any kind of problem. You don't see that elsewhere. Elsewhere, medication is a last resort.
What are the alternatives?
Oh, my gosh, there's so many alternatives. So the boy who's not paying attention in school, well, it might be attention deficit disorder. It might be that he doesn't like school. And I give some very easy ways to tell the difference. Ask the kid, what's your favorite subject at school? If the answer is recess or lunch, maybe this is a kid who just hates school. Now, hating school is a problem, but it's not a psychiatric disorder. It should not be treated with medication. Sometimes the appropriate solution is to change the school instead of medicating the kid.
Now, in the 10 years since the book was first published, we have had the Great Recession, and economists have studied that lasting effects of entering the job market when the economy is weak can have a real impact. Have psychologists seen any lasting effect of economic trends?
Well, we are seeing a growing proportion of young people who are staying at home, not taking the plunge, and there's a big gender gap there. Young men are much less likely to take the plunge. Young women, curiously and counterintuitively, seem to be more willing to take the risk, and young men seem to be more timid and staying at home and relying on their parents' help.
And been an increase in adult children living with parents. Is that more male than female?
Yes, as I was just saying, in that 25 to 34 age group, young men are now much more likely to be living at home with their parents. And that's not merely economic. In the book Boys Adrift, I show that testosterone levels have dropped almost by half in the last 40 years. A 25-year-old man today has a testosterone level roughly the same as a 50-year-old man two generations ago. And young men rely on testosterone for part of their drive. Young women do not. And so the drop in testosterone levels disproportionately affects the motivation of young men.
Is this consistent across the country? How much variation is there across the United States or across ethnic or economic groups.
Well,
and then there are cultural differences in raising children, even in this country.
The decline in testosterone levels appears to be related to endocrine disruptors, toxins in foods and beverages and cosmetics. And there we do find variations when you look, for example, rural Norway compared with urban Denmark. You find that the people in the urban centers are much more affected than the people living out in the rural areas.
What are some of the endocrine disruptors?
Plastic bottle, that clear plastic bottle that you have your drinking water in, that plastic, polyethylene terephthalate, will leach endocrine disruptors like antimony and diethoxyphthalate into the water. I wrote about this in a scholarly paper published by the National Institutes of Health, and many researchers now have documented foods and beverages in plastic. You don't want to microwave things in plastic. It's actually quite easy to protect your son and your daughter from these effects, which accelerate the onset of puberty in girls and lower testosterone levels in boys. And I describe, you know, very simple things. Don't microwave anything in plastic. Don't buy condiments in plastic. Prefer glass instead. And if you want to have water with you on your run, pour the water into a steel canteen and carry it with you instead of using a plastic bottle.
Roland from Astoria, hi, you're on the air.
Hey, Leonard, thanks for taking my call. On the issue of ADHD and the way kids are prescribed medication, I used to be a really hyperactive, very troubled young man, and my physician had prescribed all sorts of things to my parents for me. And my folks are from Europe, and I'm first generation. They didn't believe in any of that, and they instead put me in front of a drum set years ago, and I took to it so well. It was exactly what I needed. It was a totally different school of approach, and I've been playing drums, and I'm just a happy person. I can control myself and get my creative energy out that way.
Dr. Sachs?
That's a wonderful example of a accommodation, is the term that we use in the field. There's lots of ways you can work with boys and girls who have ADHD without jumping to medication as the first resort. And again, in the book, I provide a variety of strategies I've learned. I've been a medical doctor for 30 years and a PhD psychologist. There's a lot of things to do before you use medication, and medication should never be the first resort, and it shouldn't be the only intervention. But in this country, and really only in this country, medication is often the first resort for a kid who's struggling, and it is often the primary intervention. Without the attempt to bring in the drum set that the caller described, to find some accommodation to help channel this boy's energy in a constructive way.
Getting back to something you were talking about earlier, Gloria Steinem once said, and I'm quoting, "We should raise boys like we raise girls." What do you think she was suggesting there?
Well, in one sense, of course, I agree. We want boys and girls both to grow up to be kind, caring, compassionate, assertive, to find their voice. But what the research has shown us in the years since she made that comment is that what boys need to become men is different from what girls need to become women. And if we ignore that and we pretend that gender doesn't matter, we don't end up with boys who want to do scrapbooking and girls who want to do computer coding. On the contrary, we end up with boys who are spending their free time playing violent video games and girls who are spending their free time photoshopping their pictures for Instagram so they look better in a bikini. You need to understand the gender differences, and then you can break down the gender stereotypes. Again, in my book, Boys Adrift, I describe schools that have been very successful in getting boys to love Emily Dickinson, to love Jane Eyre, to write poetry. The same boys who love football can love Jane Eyre and Jane Austen if you know how to teach it. And the same girls who are on social media can love computer coding, can love physics, if you understand how to teach it differently.
There's a discussion and debate over transgender issues that wasn't happening 10 years ago. What's your take on that debate?
Oh, my goodness. So Penguin Random House has invited me to rewrite my first book, Why Gender Matters, except now there's going to be three new chapters, including one whole chapter just on transgender. And I hope you'll have me back next year when that comes out, because it is a complex issue, it is in many ways a new issue. As recently as 10 years ago, experts in the field, like Professor Bailey at Northwestern, estimated that the true incidence of transgender was 1 in 20,000. I just got a journal article in the mail yesterday, that must have been Saturday. The true incidence of transgender, they're now saying 1 in 20. Gone from 1 in 20,000 to 1 in 20 in 10 years. So there's something really strange going on there.
And another front, some research has found that our society may now be discriminating against men in ways that it long has done against women regarding weight and age, for instance. What attitudes do media cultivate about image?
Well, I think image is becoming more important for everybody. And 20 years ago, eating disorders were primarily women. Now we're seeing more and more men with eating disorders, more and more men who are saying, does this suit make me look fat? And I think that's unfortunate for everybody. I think as human beings, we want to focus on who this person is and not on how they look in a swimsuit or in the mirror.
France has banned the use of models identified as excessively thin. Should we be doing something like that in this country?
Boy, that's a tough question. Some women are very slender by nature, and not because they have an eating disorder, but certainly when that's all girls see, that girl who is not very slender may think there's something wrong with her. And one of the solutions for that is to connect her to a community of real women so that she has a sense of what's normal. Because, again, in this country, you find we've broken the bonds across generations. And so girls are looking to social media and the internet for some guidance about what they're supposed to be and what they're supposed to look like. We need to recreate strong communities of women for girls.
We've been talking with Dr. Leonard Sachs about the revised and updated edition of his book, Boys Adrift, The Five Factors Driving the Growing Epidemic of Unmotivated Boys and Underachieving Young Men. It is published by Basic Books. And I thank you so much for being on our show again. And
thanks again for inviting me.
And maybe we will be talking about transgender in a year or so.
I hope so.